It's Coin Talk, one of our biggest shows yet. This week, I talked to Nathaniel Popper, who is the Bitcoin crypto correspondent for the New York Times. I don't know if I've ever heard him on a podcast. Can't say definitively that he hasn't been on one, but if he hasn't, it's kind of shocking that he chose this show to be his first appearance. I really appreciate it. Jay and I also wrapped up Consensus Week by picking apart a 20-minute promotional video that was shown during a party on a yacht in which two Aston Martins were already given away. I thought I had become desensitized to crazy crypto shit, and this video reinvigorated my sense of the absurd and inexplicable in crypto. Highly recommend that segment. If you'd like to get in touch with us, it's hi@cointalk.show. All the episodes are at medium.com/cointalk. That's because our partner in all this is Medium. They've got lots of great writing, more all the time, and you can always read it free up to a couple articles a month, and then you should become a member. It's $5 a month. It unlocks all kinds of great stuff, including the transcripts of every episode of this show. Oh, one more logistical note. If you are reading along with us as part of the Fake Internet Money Book Club, we posted the first episode. We will have the second episode out very shortly. Read along up through chapter 7. Okay, here's the show.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Monday, May 21st at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $8,126.
Back in the crypto cave, Jay Kang, hello.
I have not seen the famous crypto cave cockroach so far.
To be determined. I don't want to give anything away by saying whether he is or is not still here.
I am not wearing shoes right now.
That might not be something you want to engage in.
So how are you doing?
I'm in a little mourning here. I just saw a Telegram message from our good friend Ledger Status here that the Sumo Project is rebranding as Ryo Coin.
Wait, is that what that message was?
That's how I read it. Is that not how you read it?
Well, I didn't read it, but
how did you like know that it existed but didn't read it and it's a tweet?
Well, I saw it was something about Sumo and he said RIP, so I just imagined that Sumo had stopped existing.
Oh no. Oh wow. And there was gonna be no condolence there if I had just like lost the giant bag.
No.
I bought in high.
No. I think we've firmly established that I have no empathy for you and your shitcoin dealings.
No, it's the project is rebranding from Sumo Coin with a K to Ryo, R-Y-O coin.
I feel like that's a mistake.
I feel that way too. Also, it's really weird how it's like going from one sort of quasi-Japanese branding to a different, like Ryo means money, or like, was the like old word for money in Japanese.
So they went from Sumo to money.
Yeah. Would you consider this ethnic appropriation?
No. I mean, I don't know who's behind Sumo Coin. It could be Japanese people.
I don't know where they're based.
But
they write, it's an English language project.
I would say that Sumo Coin has a thing to it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally why we talked about it every single, we've talked about it every single show because of the name. And Ryo Coin just sounds like a completely generic, boring project.
I totally agree.
Why did they do that? Did they explain?
I don't know. They also kind of changed the logo so it looks almost exactly like the OMG logo.
Oh, yeah, I did see that. It also kind of looks like a fucked up Chase Bank.
Yes. correct.
I don't understand why you go from having a funny, distinctive name that people talk about to going to have like the most generic name. I mean, it's not, you have nothing else to distinguish yourself.
I do think Ryo Coin does sound kind of cool, probably
no,
based on like the Street Fighter 2.
That's overlap. Ryu, first of all. Ryo Coin, it evokes nothing.
One of the hardest things in the like branding of these fork and clone coins is the like decision whether you're going to try and independently brand or brand in relation to whatever you're cloning. Like probably Sumo Coin would do the best if it called itself like Monero Dark or something like that. But I can see from an ego perspective, you don't want to be like, hey, I'm the developer of Super Monero.
You know? I don't know. I mean, like, Zeke Classic went on that insane tear. I mean, you know, like, I think in the end, the possibilities financially probably are cooler than the name. But, like, Sumo Coin had a huge pump as Sumo Coin and then a precipitous downfall.
But would you say that, like, some of these coins that have already pumped, maybe you want to rebrand them so you could, like, pump them again for the first time?
No. Ryo coin, that's horrible. Are you going to sell your Ryo coin now that it's, or your Sumo coin now that it's called Ryo coin?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah,
my
exactly. They lost the customer.
My nostalgia was for the, like, and also I don't like me and Ledger were also talking about how I had that coin PSOW and it rebranded to XSN and you had to go, not rebranded, it actually like switched chains. You had to like send in and they'd rebate you the other one. And if you didn't, they just got destroyed. Fuck that. Like, I don't want to like follow these coins as they like rebrand and go in and out of business.
Just stick with a name.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter.
I feel like that would be a strong play from the exchanges if they were just like, yeah, no, you can't start another business at this Twitter handle.
Yeah. Like, and also, like,
we listed you.
When has a rebrand ever gone well on these sorts of lines? In our field, Fusion became Splinter, you know, and now everyone's just like, wait, what's Splinter? I kind of knew what Fusion was. Sumo Coin was probably top 10 best name in crypto.
I agree. And also you go bold with the K and then you don't want to stick with that?
Yeah. Yeah, you already made a bold choice. Stick with your bold choice. You know, you have to ride it out a little bit. All right, so what do we got this week other than, your shitcoin?
We did a little interview. Jay was out shooting, so I went on a little bit of a solo field trip and talked to Nathaniel Popper. That's coming up. As our interviews go, I would say that was on the like sober end of the spectrum. So I feel like we...
Wait, what do you mean by that?
I mean, like, it's not as silly as some of the things that go on this program.
So it's not asking Doug Kim, like, what his waves bag is.
Yes.
Like.
There's no, like, shilling of low-cap alts going on in it. It was a great interview, but I thought we could do something a little more lighthearted and insane before that. Consensus was last week, I guess.
Yeah.
Finished. And...
We're taping this on a Monday afternoon.
We're taping this on Monday. The wave of weird things people witnessed at Consensus is slowly rolling in right now. And I'm always kind of like, oh, yeah, these guys went to a strip club after, like, who cares, blah, blah, blah.
Are those some of the stories?
Yeah, I think there was, like, a story about, like, a bunch of people going to, like, the box afterwards, which is
were
like,
they,
ooh, the box, ooh.
Were they trying to pay in crypto?
Yeah, I don't know. They were, like, maybe, like, doing coke at the box. Who fucking cares?
Who cares? Yeah.
But it takes something truly extraordinary to blow my mind. And some reports started rolling in that there had been a yacht. People had gone on a party on a giant boat in which two Aston Martins had been given away. And an extremely long, bizarre promotional video was played. I went into this thinking it would be good for a chuckle. And I went out thinking this may be the greatest document of the crypto era created so far.
Wait, so how did you win the Aston Martins?
The Aston Martins, you basically won, like, they handed out, I think, bracelets, and at the end of the night, only two bracelets were, like, lit up, and if those if you had one of those bracelets on, you won an Aston Martin, which is, like, a $150,000 car?
Maybe more.
Maybe
depending.
More.
Yeah.
I have actually no idea. You could tell me it cost $1 million. I don't know.
I think they're, like, $250,000.
I think if, like, maybe you could get additional bracelets if you, like, gave up your social media information. But, like, the party was for a company called Decentral, which I will admit, like, do you know what Decentral was?
No, but I feel like that's another boring generic name.
Also another boring generic name. This video is pretty incredible, though. Should we set the scene at all here?
Sure.
So, you're on a yacht. I mean, we ourselves were not
okay,
on
can
a yacht.
Okay, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
We don't have a publicist, but how did we not get on this yacht?
We need to get on the circuit.
Really? How does one get on the circuit?
I don't know. Maybe one of our guests can tell us.
Was our friend Niraj on this boat?
He was. He was the one who told me about the video. And everything that I'm playing is from like a Facebook live video at the event. So you're basically getting what the experience of someone who attended was, which was... You're at a party. You've been in this situation. You're at a party, and a guy comes out and starts trying to get everyone to go, like, be quiet. So the, like, promotional thing that the free booze came from can be shilled briefly.
Okay, I've never been to that type of party.
You've never been to that kind of a party?
I've never been to a party where somebody comes out.
Have you ever been to South by Southwest?
No.
Okay, this is the kind of thing that happens at a corporate-sponsored party.
I've never been to one of those.
I went to, like, the FIFA 16 Xbox launch, or maybe 14, and it was like Drake was going to play against like MLS players in FIFA or something.
That sounds fun.
And like the head of like EA Sports came out and was like, hey, thank you for being here. We're all one big family.
Oh, wait, you know what? I lied. I have been to one of these things. Yes. I went to a Super Bowl party when it was in Indianapolis, and I went in and almost immediately, this guy pops out of the wall, it seems like, and he's like, I'm from Lacoste, and we're giving away stuff. So they gave me a bag. I was extremely drunk, mind you. And you go into this weird side room, and you can fill up this bag with Lacoste stuff. And I looked up, and the guy filling up a bag next to me was Terrell Owens.
There you go.
That's my story.
Legendary.
However, I will say that they didn't at no point stop the party. So there are these parties where they'll stop the party.
The correct decision is not to try to make someone who is at a party promoting your brand watch an extended short film about it. We are talking about a crypto company's self-promotion, which means that taste, compassion, and general like editing style is out the window.
Or etiquette.
When I started watching this video, I was like, this could literally go on for 3 hours based on the pace. I have no idea where this is going, how long it's going to take. And we were going to, ask you to watch the entire video for me, but I don't feel like we can subject the audience to it. So I made a super cut. This is a 2 minutes out of a 23 minute video.
So we're on a yacht and we have these bracelets on. And we have been told to be quiet.
All right, this is a super special night. This is probably the most special night of any one of your lives. Guys, stop talking. There are two beautiful Aston Martins, some DB11s out there. Did anyone see the Bitcoin and Ethereum car? Look at your bracelets tonight, because those bracelets qualify you to win one of those two cars tonight!
Wait, okay. Guys, Aaron, I need your attention. Right now?
Okay, so I want to set the stage here. This is like a multi-level boat.
Yeah.
Like, it's a boat with, like, terraces. So these guys are on stage. There's one guy who I understand to be like the guy who's behind Decentral. I think his name is Anthony.
Sure.
And I think he's maybe one of the Ethereum co-founders. But the guy who's talking is like a party hyper kind of guy. And the guy, Anthony, is basically dressed in what I would describe as like Jimmy Iovine style. He's got like tinted purple sunglasses and he keeps whispering in the other guy's ear and telling him what to say. And that was just 30 seconds, but there's a full 4 or 5 minutes of him shushing the crowd and telling people like, hey, man, it's just a 20-minute video. Could you just give us 20 minutes, man?
Wait, so at some point, I heard that he says, this is probably the best night of your life.
Yeah, he's like, this is probably the best night of everyone here's life.
Is everyone on the boat, like, did they all come from Guantanamo?
I mean,
like, who are these people whose best night of their life is watching a 20-minute promotional video?
So, we're not actually going to play it, but, like, after that, they showed the first half of this video, which was a polished documentary about a co-working space in Toronto that a bunch of projects, decentralized projects, came out of and is now rebranding itself as a 15,000 square foot space that's going to be an incubator for all of the projects, which they've been doing in stealth mode, and now they're finally going to unveil them for you.
Is that what Decentral is? Is it a co-working space?
It seems like it's a co-working space. Everyone in the video was wearing like Jax t-shirts. You know Jax, J-A-X-X, Jax?
Yes, I remember the day when I came to your house for a barbecue and you told me to download Jax.
It was
wallet.
One of my first wallets I had because it had Shapeshift built into it.
Why is it not more popular? Like,
I think
you're the only one that I do that was using
Jax. I think it's
Jax.
Like a fairly popular iOS wallet.
All right, let's keep going.
Guys, I need your attention. Come on, I love you all. I don't want to be a dick up here. I'm like a nice guy. All I need is 20 minutes of your time, please.
It's like he's selling a timeshare.
We are all on a journey to a new decentralized world. Before we can arrive in this new land, there are a number of problems that must be understood.
And now we have the guy Anthony from who we've seen on stage, like his animated avatar, and he's like walking around with a little penguin.
Does he look like Jimmy Iovine still?
He still looks like Jimmy Iovine, and he's like talking to no one or talking to the penguin, and the monorail sort of goes into the middle of the white blank desert and drops them off. And while he's in the monorail, he's kind of like lecturing the penguin about the coming era of decentralization.
Let's hear what Jimmy Iovine has to say.
Must be understood and overcome. The first is around trust. Since the dawn of age, we've had to put our trust in others. They control our money. It means that you are not in control of your life. We live in a very polarized world, whether it be in politics or in communities. There's a growing tribe mentality. This binary thinking creates toxic environment and not ideal win-win situations. Decentral, we are problem solvers. Satoshi provided a blank canvas.
Okay, so what we have here is we have Bitcoin Sam Harris then.
We
have like a very calm voice telling us that the entire world is falling apart because of tribalism. That happens that is just because like Sam Harris looks at his Twitter mentions and decides that too many people are angry with him. Like that's what this sounds like.
Well, I feel like you're almost giving it like way too much coherence there. We were watching a documentary about a like co-working space that had some good Ethereum projects coming out of it. And then all of a sudden we went into a 3D animated world and we started talking about like tribal factionalism and how you can't be in control of your life. If you can't be in control of your money, we just went pretty far down the spiral here without any real explanation of where we're going.
How's this linked to the co-working space?
All we know is that Decentral are problem solvers, and that they were the co-working space.
And they're using Satoshi's vision to get rid of all the tribalism.
Satoshi created the canvas. Now they're going to make something.
This very intellectual dark web. Upon us.
This is why we built Jax for you. But the wallet is just a start. It's also gamified with an avatar, experience points, and leveling up system. And Jax Liberty is the one-stop gateway the masses will use. Although software and infrastructure has been our main focus, we're excited to show you our line of hardware solutions. The Jax Cube. Console to go along with your home entertainment system. Enter the Jax Ice Cube.
Okay, so I'm just going to recap. I'm not going to comment. They just introduced three products. The Jax Wallet, which is something we already knew about. But
gamified wallet.
It's now gamified, and it's got like a social network and charting and graphing.
Avatar.
Then the Jax Cube, which is some kind of a set-top box, like an Apple TV. They said it's a home.
You can link it to your home entertainment.
Yeah. And you can use it to connect to a bunch of different blockchains. So I guess it's so you can like rent Ethereum movies.
I will not be watching that.
And then the Jax Ice Cube, which confusingly is something totally different than the Jax Cube. It sounds like it's like a Trezor Ledger offline, like a hardware wallet product.
Let me just say, like the idea of a gamified wallet is hysterical to me. Like there already is a game.
Will your
with
money
a wallet.
Still be there?
Yeah, but it's also like, you know what? There is a leveling up. It's called getting more money into this wallet. Like I don't know if we need another game on top of that. Like is the game?
I'm gonna take the.
No, you're not. You are not about to take the opposite.
I'm gonna take the opposite side here, and it seems like. The gamification, like as companies compete to be your financial partner, it seems like gamified elements, like the way like points work in credit cards and like various incentives to use their ecosystem rather than the like Coinbase or Binance ecosystem, kind of makes sense. I am following it a little bit. Okay, it's a little gamified.
Jesus Christ.
I predict this is a trend, is that people are going to keep rewarding you for like using their system by giving you their own shitcoin, which doesn't cost them anything, much like airline miles.
What does that mean though? Like it's like, is that what they're talking about?
Let's listen.
Okay. Designed to be connection and cable free and fit in your safe or safe to deposit box.
Put in your
now
safe.
Now let's look at other products on our roadmap. Designed to be sold in convenience stores all over the world. Our coin card is a solution to get crypto in the hands of the masses. Enter Decentral Academy. This is where projects will be explained in a non-biased fashion.
Oh, of course, the fake news media here.
Okay, so we just had two more products introduced. The Jax card, which is, as far as I can tell, is like one of those green dot cards that you can buy at like a 7-Eleven that's just like a prepaid value card, except it's for crypto. A, this is basically like covering every possible base.
Yeah.
And B, after that high-minded stuff about warring tribalism in the country, you basically just like, and we will also be doing a weird prepaid value money laundering card.
Well, look, I mean, they have basically put out a suite of products, I would say, that rivals any sort of scam from, I would, what, like around 2010 or something like that, 2008. They have a card. They have a completely useless appliance. They have another appliance that you can put in your safe.
We don't know
that
these appliances are useless.
They have some gamified thing.
It might not work. I would say if I had built all of those things, they also said Jack's Academy, which I looked into. I zoomed into the screenshot a little bit. It's non-biased, but it's just basically Wikipedia, except only entry is about crypto. It's basically like answering the question, like, what is Bitcoin? Like in an article. But if you're doing all this stuff, like when you come out with it one at a time, like you're just going to come out with every possible product.
Yeah, especially when the products are these. Well, I will say that I think that I really do think that there is like something going on in Canada, because like this idea of the academy is biased is what he's basically saying. Like that's a very Jordan Peterson idea.
This is all Toronto world.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. I feel like there's something weird going on in Toronto.
At Decentral, we're all about education. Our Decentral Collector Card Project creates physical, verifiable cards and is tied in with the gamification elements found in Jack's Liberty. They will be sold
that's
in
packs. That's basically
online.
Like their own Magic the Gathering cards that have like Satoshi on them, and you can play some kind of like a blockchain based game with it.
Is it Satoshi the unbeatable card in that?
Yeah, he's like the Black Lotus of
yeah, exactly.
Finally, to tie everything together, Decentral Unity, the new loyalty system and coin for Jack's Liberty. We're building a decentralized world, all the while doing it based on the unique guiding principles of not asking people for money. It's time for personal responsibility. It's time for us to trust technology. Join us on this journey.
Thank you for listening, everybody. That's
okay, so the last thing that he introduced there was Decentral Unity, which is kind of burying the lead because it's their coin.
Oh.
And it's the thing that unites all of these projects. So what I assume is like your pre-K card, your Magic the Gathering cards, your rewards for using the wallet, all of your transactions for renting Ethereum movies and the set-top box. The like native currency of all of it is JXX, aka Decentral Unity.
Have you been to Hong Kong?
I have not. I'd like to, though.
Okay, so there's this thing called Chungking Mansion there.
Yeah.
And it's like every immigrant from around the world is in it. And it's this huge cavernous space. And inside, they sell like a lot of old electronics and cell phone minutes or like long distance minutes. The great Wong Kar-wai movie Chungking Express is about Chungking mansions.
Yes.
This is basically that. I mean, it is like a wealth of scammable products.
Yeah.
And then in the end, he talks about his time to take personal responsibility. Like, what the fuck? Like, this really is like some weird intellectual dark web thing. It was almost like, we need a kick here. What's cool right now? Oh, it's this sort of ideology coming out about how, like, you know, everything's biased and we're all indoctrinated and warring and therefore we need personal responsibility. It's fucking crazy.
What I read it a little differently than you. It felt like Scientology to me a little bit.
Well, it's the same thing.
It's like there are problems in the world, and then it's like listing a bunch of generic have always existed in the world problems, and then it's like, and what about solutions? Personal responsibility and a set-top box and a gaming cart. And it's like, wait a minute. Only some of those things are like, okay, I can agree with you that decentralization, perhaps even Bitcoin and virtual currencies, could be said to be addressing the issues set forth at the beginning of this monorail.
Okay, explain how.
I also forgot to say that the penguin is also a backpack and flies around like a jetpack.
Stop deflecting about the... Explain your take that Bitcoin
if you
can
believe
solve
that
war
the
infections.
Well, I'm not saying it can solve it. I'm saying... If you believe that the world is full of warring factions and that like civility and decency have broken down, I can see why you would want to support Bitcoin and decentralization projects.
Why?
Because those would allow you to survive in the post-industrial wasteland that exists after your world.
That is not solving it. That's exterminating everybody else.
But I really don't understand like what the like prepaid cards and Magic the Gathering
stuff.
We're
not talking about it. We're really addressing your defense of this idea that Bitcoin could solve it. You could just punt. You could just say, I believe,
can Bitcoin solve it? I don't really believe that that's what the world is like. So I don't think Bitcoin can solve the fake problems set forth by the man and the penguin on the monorail. Although I will say, if they like do come out with backpack, jetpack penguins like that, I'm intrigued.
You can have like a conversation.
Yeah, and the budget on this video gotta be way up there. I mean, first we had like a pretty high production value, like Verite documentary footage of this guy like playing ping pong in his co-working space. And then we have this 3D animation with a penguin. Like, what do you think this whole thing cost?
$3 million.
You could tell me anything from $100,000 to $3 million and I would believe you.
Okay, but how many?
And
how
it's
many,
all about how much they fleeced the guy who made the video.
How many Jack's Liberty coins do you think it costs?
Well, I do wonder if some of these times when I see people who are issuing like a coin, and this is basically, it's not an ICO situation. It's a loyalty coin. It's not an ICO. It's a loyalty coin. But when I see someone doing this, I'm like, are they just funding this all with the investment coming into the coin? Like, I would be really unhappy if I had just put a bunch of money into a coin and then I saw them make this video.
Well, I guess maybe the guy who made it will be like the David Cho, the Facebook graffiti artist who like had $200 million or something because he got paid in Facebook stock.
I mean, we got to get in on this stuff.
I know. Well, look, we were not at the fucking party.
They showed a 23-minute video and they only introduced JXX, Decentral Unity Coin, at like minute 22.
Did anyone boo at the end of this?
I didn't hear anyone booing, but like, okay, you don't think that Bitcoin is a solution to those problems, but do you think...
What problems?
Wait, hold on. Do you think that the popularity of Bitcoin can impartially be attributed to people who believe that the problems set forth by the man, his penguin on the monorail, are like the course of the world? I'm not saying that I believe that that's the situation the world is in, but I do believe that people who do believe the world is in that situation will buy Bitcoin, and therefore I'm bullish.
I have no idea what you just said. I will say that if you look into the philosophies of the types of people who believe this, because it's not an uncommon thing, right? To say that the world is too hyper-factionalized and we need to have a normalizing force that will completely change the world economy. It's what Roger Ver was crying about when he talked about how Madeleine Albright could just bomb children and nobody cares because of, you know, this corrupt financial system.
Yes.
Their solution tends to be social Darwinism. You know, like if someone is too stupid to buy Bitcoin now, then they don't deserve to be rich and therefore they can be like basically, well, who cares what happens to them? And therefore we will just have a consensus of people who own Bitcoin and there will be no more factionalism. And that is a terrible philosophy for the world. I didn't hear anything in Jimmy Iovine here's speech that convinced me that he had thought about it any deeper, except that he was somehow telling me that the cards you could buy at 7-Eleven were somehow like integral to the actual unity of the world.
What's kind of incredible to me is not only that these are your views, but you're like, you know where I should air these views? During a Aston Martin giveaway on a yacht through 3D animation of me, like a Uncanny Valley semi-realistic version of my own avatar talking to a penguin that's also a rocket jetpack. What the fuck is this as a way to like tell people about this? And also, like, why are you throwing parties in which you try to convince people that the world is descending into like a factional splinter war?
Well, because you believe that. Like, you actually believe that's what the world
is. But how did we come to believe that in such a short time? That's
because
what kind of blows my mind.
You're fucking crazy.
Is it you're kind of crazy, or is this kind of part of the power,
Aaron,
of Bitcoin?
Oh my God. The video or the audio that you just played, right?
I'm not saying it's not crazy. I'm like,
is the rantings of an unhinged mind. There is no question about that.
I feel like it's someone who immersed themselves in an ideology and then very deeply embraced certain select portions of that ideology.
Yeah.
And
they believe it.
What's fascinating to me is how quickly we went from the like Genesis block to this sort of cultural, ideological decentralization stuff.
Look, I think that it is a lot to say that everyone believes this.
Oh, no, definitely not. But this is like one of the founders of a co-founders of a theory.
Sure, but that it is also true that like people can go off and say, Yeah. Like some people do splinter off and make these types of projects.
I also think this was a fundamental like miscalculation, and you can see it on the faces of the people both before and after they play the video. It is dawning on them how batshit this is. Like, to me, this is like a really long email someone sent from a dorm room with $1 million budget.
like coming down from their first mushroom trip. All right, so should we get to Nathaniel?
Absolutely.
All right, I'm interested to know what he had to say. He's like I've enjoyed his book.
Yeah, and we've been a fan of his writing. Like when he wrote about Ripple, I feel like some of these topics are waiting around for a like more definitive investigative take. Yeah. And I'm glad that there's someone doing that. And I was pretty curious as to like how he does that, because these are not companies that are like receptive to like transparent journalism.
Well, yeah. I mean, the cudgel of the times is pretty good there, where you can just be like, you know, I don't care what you think. And that's actually why I enjoy his reporting, because he clearly does not care what anyone in crypto, like he's not trying to make friends with anyone in crypto.
No, so. Definitely not. Although, even though he doesn't want to make friends with anyone in crypto, everything he writes moves the market. Like if he writes about something that has never been written about in the New York Times, it's a pretty big deal.
Rio coin.
You think it's Rio, right?
Rio coin.
All right, let's.
I think you need to get out of Rio coin, Aaron.
Yeah, but what if like, okay, won't I feel really stupid though if it like pumps really hard on the rebrand?
Yeah, but like anything could pump. Do you really want to be into Rio coin?
I mean, I do if it's going to pump. I bought Sumo High. Now I'm inheriting Ryo Low.
Let me disavow you. It probably won't pump. All right, let's go to
Nathaniel.
All right,
Nathaniel Popper. Welcome, Nathaniel Popper.
Thank you for having me.
How's your consensus going?
How's my consensus going? Well, I haven't gotten in quite as many private hip-hop concerts as I was hoping.
You only got to go to one of the two Snoop concerts?
Right, and missed the Busta Rhymes concert at the same time. But, you know, you can't have everything.
Is this like the biggest week of the year for you? Is this like fashion week if you work at T Magazine?
You know, last year I didn't even go to this. I was out on paternity leave. And the years before that, you know, this was like a one-day thing. I think the last time I went, it was a one-day thing in the Times, New York Times here. And, you know, it was 800, 1,000 people. It was not this production that it's become. I mean, I have to say, like, I was really astonished when I walked in and saw what this had become. I had not, you know, even being in the middle of it, like, I hadn't quite realized that it could materialize in a physical form like this.
I saw a lot of tweets coming out from it that, like, wow, this is surprisingly legit this year. The whole production value seems like it stepped up a notch.
Yes. Perhaps the production value is a bit better. It did feel like they had the facilities for 4,000 people and sold tickets for 8,000 people in the last week, but still had the facilities for 4,000 people and nobody could walk through the hallways. And, you know, I'm sure that actually added to the sense of this being a place to be, but it also felt like maybe it weren't quite up to the number of people that turned out.
I read your book this week, which was kind of an unusual experience because it's like new enough to be pretty new, but then there was a mental block I had against reading it because it was over a year old, and I was like, oh, this is all like old hat. And it was a surprisingly emotional journey reading back through this sequence in these different people's lives. And it
you
strikes
laughed,
me.
You laughed, you cried.
I laughed, I cried, I learned a little something. And it has struck me that, you know, you've been on this journey. Like, when did you first get exposed to Coin World?
So my first story was the story about the Winklevoss twins and their hoard. They came to us and kind of said, you know, we're ready to go public with this thing. And that was in April 2013, kind of in that mania where it went above $200 for the first time. And, you know, I was covering financial markets at the time for the Times. Didn't have much of a sense of it, but we just didn't have anybody covering it. And I wrote that. And they were really, you know, they were the first people to ever, whose name anybody knew, to sort of put their name to Bitcoin. And so that, I think, was a big sort of development for Bitcoin. And that story went nuts. You know, it was the most read story in the Times for a while. And after that, I was just, you know, the person who knew about Bitcoin, you know, having written one story about it at that time.
It's funny thinking back, that story is like perfect buzzword SEO magic. These minor celebrities, you know, from a movie, like nascent technology and like massive financial gain.
It had it all. And it had Harvard even, which, you know, for the New York Times, bonus. If you get Harvard in a story, you're basically a
trifecta.
Yeah.
What point did like writing about Bitcoin become part of your week to week life?
Even a year into it, it was still like, this can't be your whole job. Like, this is not serious enough to be your whole job. And, you know, I went out on book leave. I wrote the book, and that was obviously a full-time job. But when I came back, you know, it still wasn't something that the New York Times would have an entire reporter dedicated to.
Yeah.
And so I was covering Wall Street banks and then moved out to San Francisco to cover tech. And I just kept finding my way back to it. And every time it kind of blew up again, I'd be the person. And, you know, it was really, I think, since September of last year that it's like, okay, this is all I'm doing. I am supposed to be covering some other things. I'm supposed to be covering Square and PayPal and Lending Club and, you know, some of these financial startups. But
those stories feel comparatively pretty small.
Yeah,
I just can't.
Thankfully, Square is all of those people are now getting into.
Like those people
are
getting in line
world.
And just merging into your story,
right.
So you don't have to like cover them separately.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, very considerate of them. Yeah, I mean, it's just become this thing that you can't look away. I mean, and so really, it's been over the last 6 months that it's just been daily. And interestingly, before 6 months ago, other publications maybe had one person. And now we're unusual because we only have one person covering this. And most of these other publications have, you know, 5-10 people. Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal now have like whole staffs on this.
I wanted to ask you about that because if there was a point in time where it felt like, wow, this isn't enough for a full-time job. Right now, like covering ICOs and covering like Bitcoin core development, these are like
disparate
fields.
And then like these like, you know, corporate blockchain developments and the government stuff with Russia and Venezuela.
It feels like you'd want like a team if you were going to cover all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly feels overwhelming on many days, the number of things that are going on. You know, there are really these very distinct worlds within crypto and blockchain land.
Warring worlds, really.
A lot of them don't get along and think the other ones are idiots. I mean, everybody thinks that everybody else is
That's a consistent theme.
Land.
You can just say that after any statement and
just,
everyone thinks everyone
before
else
I
is
go
idiot.
Into each conversation, I just have to remember who I'm going to make fun of with this person because I can't make fun of their group, but I can make fun of all the other groups. But
do people think that when you're hanging out with like Bitcoin, like cash advocates, they're like, Nathaniel is clearly like more into Bitcoin cash than like the regular Bitcoin.
Well, I think that actually the opposite. Everybody thinks I'm against them.
You're like a ref. You're like an NBA playoffs ref.
Everybody boos me.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the Ripple people think I'm a Bitcoin maximalist who wants Bitcoin to succeed. And, you know, the Bitcoin people all think I'm some, you know, corporate sellout who doesn't understand the values of decentralization and, you know,
and,
the true philosophy.
And you're really, in the tank for Silicon Valley and really want Coinbase,
and
Ethereum world to thrive.
Right. So everyone kind of generally hates me. But, you know, there are enough people out there who I think like me just want to kind of think about all of this logically, skeptically, and try to not make any assumptions. I mean, I think, you know, I tend to have success because there are a lot of people in this world who just want to sell things, but there are enough people who think there's something here, but realize that there are a lot more iterations that you have to go through. And so to get back to the question of like, you know, covering all this, I mean, I do have all of these different universes, you know, the kind of corporate blockchain universe and the regulatory government universe and the, you know, Bitcoin world and the Ethereum world and all the altcoins. And I have my people in each of those worlds. And frankly, I think, you know, for the sake of the New York Times, it's good that we don't have more people because I think a lot of people who have stepped up coverage, it just becomes overwhelming.
Yeah.
And there is a great tendency in this universe to lose the forest for the trees and to not be able to step back and say, like, what's really going on here? What are we really accomplishing? You know, what's the big picture?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I really like about the coverage that you do in the New York Times is if you're going to write about something like, say, Ripple, it seems like you're trying to write the definitive article about Ripple more than the like 97th 300 word blog post about like some new Ripple
right,
test
what happened
program
this week
with DHL in Malaysia, or, you know, there's a level to which like the news is being generated constantly, but I don't know that reading 100 news items about Ripple actually tells you that much about what Ripple is.
Right.
And the way that you're able to focus in on sort of the general, like, what is happening here is helpful for someone like me who's like interested in this, but like, I don't want to dedicate like 2 or 3 hours of my day every day to reading about it. Are you reading No. about it 2 or 3 hours every day?
I fear that I might be. I do actually have to like not read
Yeah.
and sort of step back from it, because, you know, you can just get lost in the wash of information and not be able to pull back. And I mean, this is, I think, true generally for journalists, where you have to not look at Twitter and you have to stop reading and
Yep.
you have to just like think about things a little bit. And there's another layer here that makes that important. And that's that the crypto universe kind of, it creates this, all of these projects put out news because they're trying to move their coin price.
Yep. And often not very elegantly put out news.
Yeah. And a lot of it's kind of irresponsible and not thought through. And so it's very easy to become like a proxy in that sort of war to try to get price to move. And, you know, these little announcements, like, you really have to put them in context if you want to understand why things matter. And I do think, you know, the long, like, what people are ultimately betting on is whether any of these things are going to get used in, you know, 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. Even exist in 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. Yes.
I would consider it successful if a lot of these projects made like an existing product that fell on deaf ears. That would be like,
right,
a huge accomplishment for the majority of coins.
Like, right, failing honestly would be a great outcome.
That's like making it to like the conference finals, and it's like we can all like go home proud here. People didn't want our Ethereum-based casino.
Yeah, and journalism is so integral, and like the media and social media is so integral to the kind of success of so many of these projects. That shouldn't necessarily be the case. Like, these projects should be about whether they're actually gaining traction, getting users, doing what they said they're going to do. And if you just sort of follow the day-to-day announcements, it's very easy to kind of, you know, lose any track of that.
What would a company that was trying to behave honestly and for the long term, like, how would we sort of know? I feel like we have a lot of tools for trying to understand what's dishonest, but I'm like, I don't even know how I would know if there was a legitimate project out there.
That's a great question, and one that I think I
not that I'm asking you for investment advice, but
no.
Sort through a million
I mean,
people who'd like
I
you to
am,
write about them.
I am not at all in the business of like trying to give anybody investment advice, but like, I don't want to sort of give a spotlight to somebody who is not building something that's real.
Yeah.
And so I am constantly trying to figure out what's real, and it's hard. I mean, look, I'm not a computer scientist,
yeah,
but I've certainly learned over time in this realm that computer scientists can't tell that any better, or often any better than anybody else, because even if the code and the math works, you have to have the incentives right. And you have to have an actual, you know, you have to have the proverbial product market fit.
And even if you were a computer scientist, you'd be not an economist.
Right.
And you would be not a cryptographer. There's no way
you would master all these
skills.
I think I've at least realized that that's not as much of a disadvantage as I might have originally thought. And really, the question I come back to like 15 times a day is, with every project, show me somebody who's going to use this. You know, this does something better than the way they used to do it, or that this honestly fulfills some new need out there, or creates some new need out there. And there are almost no projects for which somebody can, you know, show me that. And so that I think is what I'm looking for. And obviously, a lot of what's out there is, well, we're gonna do this. Look, you know, we figured this out.
Or it's like, you'll be able to use this to make more things that can then themselves generate more, like,
right.
There's a huge amount of project, the huge amount of the best known projects basically are to create more projects with. Right. I would even say that Ethereum could be
that is what Ethereum is. It's a platform for building other things. To Ethereum's credit, people have built those other things.
Yes.
So they did that, but then
CryptoKitties are real. You can really create them on the blockchain.
Really mate a digital cat.
Yeah.
And there's another example of, you know, people actually doing something. A lot of where that's happening is this kind of dark world stuff, which obviously, you know, people sort of accuse me frequently of kind of overplaying the illegal activity going on. But I think if anything, I'm underplaying. I mean, I think that is still, you know, where you can see a lot of what this enables. I mean, you know, one of the ones I've written most recently that I think of is this idea of like kidnapping and theft and ransom. Very early on, people realized that if this worked, this would be like the perfect mechanism for ransom payments. Their rebuttal to this sort of talk of illegal stuff is always, you know, but they used to do it, you could, you know, they do it even more with US dollars and cash. And the point is, you couldn't digitally send $1 million of cash to a kidnapper. Like, you had to meet that kidnapper, and that made that transaction a lot harder. And so this is a transaction that has been made easier. And that tells you something about how this thing works and what it does.
Yeah. In reading back through your book, one of the things that struck me was how long it took for people to realize that the truly non-anonymous nature of Bitcoin was going to be a pretty big issue. The fact that you could, I mean, people bring it up early on and are like, hey, it's actually a terrible criminal currency because there's a paper trace of every single thing that's ever happened on it. But it goes along this really long path. And then eventually, like in the last year, that becomes a major issue leading up to like Zcash is now being listed on Gemini. Right.
Yes. Although I'll push back a little bit and say that I think that part of the reason there's a sense that Bitcoin isn't as anonymous is because people are now selling competing products that offer more anonymity.
Interesting.
Those people in selling that have this line like, Bitcoin isn't as anonymous as you think. Look, you can get caught.
Yeah.
Because of your blockchain trail. But if you look over time at most of the big criminals in this realm who have been caught, it's not because of the blockchain trail. Yeah. Like Ross Ulbricht didn't get caught because of his Bitcoin transaction.
Old school.
Yeah. And I think that Bitcoin, if you use it right, it's still pretty anonymous. You know, you don't have to register with anybody. You have to do it right and you have to be smart about it, but it's still pretty anonymous. And Zcash, most people aren't using it in the way that makes it truly anonymous yet.
Right.
So, you know, those kinds of transactions can be traced to a certain degree. Now, I'm like, there can be more anonymous versions of Bitcoin. Not arguing with that. But, you know, I think that Bitcoin still is the way that people do most of these black market transactions. And most of the time, people get away with it.
Right.
And, you know, the cops, there are some cases, I think I remember hearing that the Secret Service agent who like tried to steal Ross Ulbricht's money. I think that may have been a case where he was actually caught because of like the blockchain trail he left. But I think that was more because he was stupid and not very good at this and not very experienced. These sort of ransom kidnappers, most of them have not been caught yet.
When you were covering the Bitcoin story early on, I noticed a real contrast between writing about something like Ripple. Ripple's a company. You can be like, that guy, he's the CEO. They've got a PR person who will respond to your queries. And then Bitcoin is this weird amorphous. There's no quote from Satoshi Nakamoto.
Right.
Even the Bitcoin Foundation and Bitcoin Core are these kind of weird, more non-profit-y type entities than a true company. Like, what were the challenges of trying to cover something that had no central authority or central voice?
Yeah, I mean, if you look back, you can tell that the people who became the spokesman for Bitcoin early on were just the people who offered themselves to the media.
Yeah.
You know, it was not because they were experts. It was because they were loud enough to get through to the media. And then once they were quoted once, they became the sort of spokespeople.
Having seen a limited amount of Roger Ver videos, these people are not like media trained.
They aren't media trained, but I think Roger was to a degree like a somewhat good representative of an early version of a Bitcoiner. And so it was like, he told a story in himself of what Bitcoin was about. And I think a lot of early users were, you know, that was kind of like, not all of them, but a lot of them were very ideological, very politically motivated. But yeah, I mean, the spokesmen early on were not probably the best people to be speaking or the most knowledgeable. You know, it takes time as a reporter, and I'm still aware of this as a reporter. I look at other reporters and, you know, why are you quoting this person? This person has no particular expertise on this. Now, at least, I try to pride myself in, like, trying to quote people who actually know about the thing that they're talking about. But it's still really hard just because there are so many charlatans out there. Just filtering through the noise is like 95% of what it takes to, like, honestly understand this space.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I mean, I assume you do not hold cryptocurrencies yourself.
That's policy here.
That's policy. Most places where people are covering this stuff, or I would have seen a disclosure from you. Do you ever feel like you're, like, missing out, or you're, like, not getting, like, I think of Bitcoin as such an experiential thing. Like, when you think back on Roger Ver, like, going and putting it on people's phones.
Right.
Like, part of the whole first wave of Bitcoin ideologically was that, like, you had to try it for yourself, hold your own private keys. I'm curious, like, what going through all that period was like for you as someone who was not doing any of those things that were supposed to, like, teach you what it was really like.
Right. Well, and this is a distinction that is worth making. Like, basically, the way I've talked with my editors, I can have, like, a small amount to play with. And the understanding is that small amount is, like, the papers instead of mine. So they're the ones, you know, who should benefit if that becomes worth, you know, $1 million. So I can play with it. I have played with, you know, most, you know, the sort of major coins to understand just how they work. Obviously, once you get started, most of them work relatively similarly. But one part of it is I know that I would be a terrible investor. Like, I'm like, I would absolutely, like, buy at every peak and sell at every trough. And so I know I wouldn't have made money being in this, and that gives me some amount of comfort. I mean, it is crazy to see some of these people who I've been covering who, you know, in the time that I've been writing about them have become millionaires, some of them billionaires.
Yeah.
That's insane. I mean, I'm not so driven by a desire for money that, like, overwhelms me. I mean, I certainly feel like this space is, like, so lacking in people who understand it, who don't have some skin in the game. And, you know, there's such a debate out there. Like, so many coin lovers sort of say journalists should own it. You know, how can they understand if you don't own it, it's like you're short Bitcoin. But, like, if you play that argument out, so do you have to own, like, every coin you're going to write about? Like, so if I write about a new coin, do I need to buy it so that I'm not short it? And do I need to buy, like, the exact same amount I have of Bitcoin?
Are you short everything you're not in the entire market?
Right. I mean, I'm relatively dismissive of these arguments, but they're so commonplace. And I think, like, people don't realize the degree to which when you own something, like, there's so many studies out there about this. When you own something, you can't see the bad about it. Like, that our brains are built so that when you are, like, invested in something, you're unable to see the shortcomings. And, like, you don't want journalists who are unable to see the shortcomings.
This has come up, like, repeatedly on the show, because we decided, not because we thought it was some genius idea, just because we were already speculating on coins, that we would do a show about our misadventures in this. And we haven't even been in it that long. I've only been in for maybe a year. I already have nostalgic associations with altcoins, like they were, like, Super Nintendo games I was into.
Right.
Where I'm like, I'm still holding sumo coin because, like, I made this joke on the show for a long time about how all the sumo coin I was holding. I mean, as a test of irrational thought, you can get yourself from 0 to 60 pretty fast. The minute you start putting some real money into these kind of investments.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a crazy thing. I mean, it's really astonishing to me to both see how quickly you can become irrational about something and how irrational you can become when you own something. Just when you see the tribalism on Twitter, you know, the coin tribalism, to me, it just like people are unable to receive information that goes against their financial holdings. Like they can't hear it. You know, like when I've written these stories, I wrote the story about Centra Tech and I mean, I've written a series of stories, you know, pointing out problems with various projects. For most of these things, anybody can just go verify what I write and find out that no, the team has not actually built what they said they were going to build, you know, Visa. But like people just won't believe it. You go on, like I'll often go on the Telegram channels of a coin after I write about it and just see what the conversation is. And it's, you know, always the same. Oh, this is just a Bitcoin maximalist trying to take down the coin, or like no discussion of there are facts in this story that you could just go verify if you want to learn whether this project is doing something legitimate. And people just so quickly get invested and they get so irrational so quickly that
I mean, sometimes it even goes a step further than that, which is a lot of these like micro cap coins, when there's like a revelation that it's just an outright like scam, people are like, I don't know, I think it might come back though.
Yeah.
Like, people are like, yeah, scamming is not like off the table. Like a good scam is still a good investment.
Yeah. No, I mean, like the day the Centra guys got arrested, I went onto the Telegram channel and people were trying to post stories from the SEC. That number one, the moderator would remove the posts from the SEC, and everybody was just saying, no, you know, there's always somebody who's trying to bring this project down. And it was like, no, go to the website. They were arrested. Like the project is over. The domain has been seized. Like people just wouldn't believe that information. And I actually posted a link, and just like there were some specific questions. I went on the Telegram and I posted a link, because somebody had read the New York Times story about this and said, how could this possibly be true? And I just posted an image from the federal prosecutor's complaint, and it was immediately moderated out. I was deleted and banned from the channel. So that's, I mean, I think that's like a pretty telling moment. Like a journalist tries to just like gives an image of actual government document, and that is grounds for being sort of banned from one of these communities. And I think that just gets at like the sort of irrationality that this brings out in people.
Yeah, I mean, how are you covering the story of all these people all over the country who are buying into crypto? Like, I think we generally see crypto from the top down, like the creators and the sort of the guys who bought low.
Yeah.
But like, really in America, the story of crypto is like people like making a Coinbase account and going and putting $500 in. I mean, I guess that's not like, I often struggle to be like, is most of the money in this, or is the most in the money like in a Peter Thiel like Zappo vault?
Right. You're right. I think on one hand, I mean, in my defense, it's really hard to tell. And I am trying to often get those figures to say like, who really does own this? And that's really hard to know. But I think we and most other publications, but you know, myself to begin with, have not done as good a job at that at all as I wish. Like I wish we had been following sort of more ordinary people who aren't longtime holders. You know, people who'd gotten into this in December and bought at the high, or January and bought at the high and have lost money, or people who got in and you know, in September and still don't really understand this, but are now, you know, have an extra $200,000. Like I think that's really important. And I wish we were writing more about this. And I think we, you know, we did one story I'm proud of from South Korea, which is, I think, a place that's particularly driven by just like ordinary sort of retail investors, you know, just putting their savings into this.
We refer to them as the Ethereum teens. There's like a lot of teen investment groups there.
And it's a lot of it's Ethereum, a lot of it's Ripple, XRP. Some of the exchanges there created these physical storefronts. And we sent a reporter there. I didn't go, but we sent a reporter and he just talked to people. And, you know, he just found all these like pensioners who were putting their retirement savings into this and didn't have any, you know, they were buying Ripple because it was cheap, you know, it was a dollar, right. It was $2, and Bitcoin was, you know, $10,000, obviously like a totally useless way of sort of calculating.
They weren't wrong in that first wave though. Like we were like, I bet people are going to like bid like Ripple up to a dollar from 30 cents because, you know, psychology. And I was like, oh shit, this is happening?
Yeah. Well, they weren't wrong that they weren't wrong that other people would think the same thing.
Their dumb psychology turned out to be a human dumb psychology.
Yeah, I mean, that was like a mass movement that was driven by a wrong economic assumption, which is fine, and that worked. And that, I mean, and to be fair, I'm not saying that's like the only reason that people were buying Ripple, but putting a face on the people who were actually buying in South Korea just made this, whenever I do try to write those stories, I do feel like you just come out with such a clear sense of the reasons that ordinary people are buying. And even if they aren't, you know, even if they don't account for the vast majority of holdings, they're the most, the biggest number of people are people like that. And, you know, I think it's those people who are the most vulnerable here.
I'm just starting to like really wrap my head around Bitcoin maximalism, taken literally rather than sort of figuratively. We're doing a book club on the show, and I've been reading Saifedean Ammous's book, The Bitcoin Standard, which is sort of like, it's laying out the like case for Bitcoin maximalism.
I've read some of the reviews.
Yeah, I recommend it. I think it's very good. And I was sort of comparing, because I was reading it at the same time I was reading your book, Digital Gold, and switching back and forth. And there's like lots of long-term questions about Bitcoin that existed 3 years ago, still exist, that I can sort of like move my head around, like, oh, the electricity. But I'm like, oh, but like, we actually have more electricity than we need on Earth. There's a lot of these things that I'm like, yeah, people are going to figure this out. The one lingering one of like why it's hard for me to really embrace the idea of a Bitcoin maximalist worldview is this idea that a very small group of people, many of whom you probably have personally, socially encountered, would inherit, let's just say 10% of the wealth of the world. Not inherit, would possess that. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that's hard for me to sort of project into the future. Like, even thinking as like a reporter, like, how do you tell the story of like, if this works, like, Peter Thiel has 3% of the money in the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's a scary piece of this. Yeah. I think it's something that people don't contend with that much. I mean, it doesn't feel like that's a world that most people would want to live in.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like the idea here, but it does feel very telling that with all of these coins, you have vast holdings, you know, in the hands of a very small number of people.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of in keeping with a lot of elements of the way this has played out, which is, you know, this is, again, all supposed to be about decentralizing power, putting hands back in the, and like, yes, theoretically, the system could be used to do that. But when you look at every turn, the opposite is the case. You know, at every turn where things could, you know, cohere into a sort of small, in the hands of a small number of people, they have. And I think that's something, again, that like the whole universe of people looking at this don't really think about. Like, they think
that
theoretically,
for that question.
They think that theoretically it could decentralize power. They don't. I think contend as much as they should with the fact that practically, like, that's not what's happening. And maybe it'll change. You know, maybe everything will start to become more distributed. But like, so far, the evidence we have doesn't point to that happening.
It seems more likely the opposite would happen, which is as Bitcoin becomes more legitimate, a greater share of the Bitcoin would be possessed by like funds and various entities that hold large amounts of wealth.
Yeah, I mean, which is largely how the world works today.
Continues, and, yeah, always has worked.
Right, but I think you would then have this sort of unusual outlier of these kind of like venture investors who own like, you know, 30, 40, 50%.
Just to happen to own basically like 3 or 4 countries worth of money now. Just them and professional poker players, as far as I've come to tell. A lot of people who were playing online poker did very well over the last few years.
That's a fascinating kind of like subset. I think there are like some different interesting subsets of people, like unexpected people who got into it. But on the other hand, I think that like a majority of this is still just like the venture capitalists who were getting rich on all of the startups in Silicon Valley. They just got like a 300% wealth increase. They just like happened to like jump over a weird Super Mario thing that like, oh, your wealth has just, you know, like people who had spent their entire lives venture investing and then in the course of a year made more than they had in their entire lives.
PayPal money becomes like venture money on an Uber, becomes money that got dumped into Bitcoin, becomes money that ends up in Ethereum.
Like, right.
300 might be conservative in terms of some of the exponential economics.
Yeah.
What does it mean that the first big idea since the internet, like really like the first thing that competes with the internet in terms of like how big it could be, didn't really come from Silicon Valley, did not come from the venture capital world, the Y Combinator startup world? Like, what does it tell us, and how do you think that the Valley is reacting to the fact that this one isn't really like on their scorecard?
I mean, that does go back to a little bit to the question of like, who is Satoshi?
Right.
And I think
we assume Satoshi did not go through Y Combinator.
We definitely not through Y Combinator. But I do think when you look back at the history of like the cypherpunks and particularly this conversation around digital money.
Yeah.
It was at like meetups in Mountain View and Palo Alto. And, you know, I mean, the guys, whether or not Hal Finney and Nick Szabo were, you know, part of the Satoshi team, they were part of what led to Bitcoin. And they're very much creatures of like the West Coast tech world.
Yeah.
There aren't too many ideas that filtered into this that didn't come from that universe. And so I think to a certain degree, Silicon Valley can take credit for this. I mean, those were a lot of the people who saw this early. And of course, Coinbase was a Y Combinator company. And I think Coinbase really is in some sense the first like big Bitcoin company. Although now, I mean, maybe you could argue Bitmain, you know, there's stuff out of China now that's happening, but still so much of the activity is, you know, moving out to the West Coast. Yeah, people are distributed, but I do feel like the kind of center of gravity is still there, even if, you know, people are working remotely. I mean, there's stuff going on in China, but so much of like the technical work on this is still kind of a Silicon Valley thing. And Silicon Valley was early to see this as something that might matter. And I think it's part of this broader sort of vision. And so it was very consistent with a lot of, I think, where Silicon Valley has been over the last decade, which is this sort of desire to disrupt this belief in sort of disintermediation, even when it doesn't end up, you know, creating a more distributed world.
It, as an outsider, it feels like while many people in Silicon Valley profiteered greatly from this, that this idea came without a central authority in some ways subverts the very idea of a company being behind a big technological leap. I don't know. I guess it sort of starts to feel like a battle for the soul of what it is. Like, is Bitcoin the protocol or is it Coinbase? Like, is it the consumer vision or is it like some essential ideological core? My final question to you, what's the big story that excites you now? I feel like each year has this kind of dominant theme. Like there was like last year was the fork year. Everything was all about forks. What do you see as the like most important thing to be keeping your eye on right now?
You know, again, I think the question this year is the same question as like last year and the year before. It is like, when are we going to start to see people doing something, you know, socially useful?
When is something going to happen?
Yeah. Like when is this? When are people going to really start to use it for something more than speculation or building other more, you know, layers of speculation on top? I'm still waiting for that. I mean, you see the signs, you see that it could happen, but I don't think you see it happening very much. And so that's always like the basic question is when is that going to happen?
Well, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Thank you.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Monday, May 21st at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $8,126.
Thank you so much for listening to Coin Talk. Thank you to Nathaniel Popper and the New York Times for hosting us. Thanks to our editor, James Nicholson. Thanks to my co-host, Jay Kang. Thanks to our partners over at Medium. You can find every episode, including transcripts, at medium.com/cointalk. If you'd like to sponsor the show, send us an email, hi@cointalk.show. We are hearing all offers. You want to offer us your weird off-brand shitcoin in exchange for a sponsorship? We are interested. The weirder, the better. I will say, if you email asking to have the CEO on and it's of a new project that hasn't launched and we don't know what it is, it's unlikely that we're going to have you on the show. However, we have sponsor slots available in every episode. It's clean, it's transparent, and people like it. One thing people don't like is homework, but if you are reading along as part of our book club, get through chapter 7 of the Bitcoin Standard for our next book club episode coming out very shortly.